Let me contextualize this the following way, where this project came about. In 1997, Hillary Clinton was the first lady and Bill Clinton was the president, and they hosted a conference at the White House on early brain development. And actually, Carla Schatz was the only neuroscientist invited to this. Pat Kuhl was also there. And shortly thereafter, the MacArthur Foundation, who's a private foundation in Chicago, approached me and asked if I would lead a research network on early experience in brain development. So we did. And there were about 10 or 11 of us in this group. And most were neuroscientists, not all. Jack Shonkoff, who some of you know, was a pediatrician in the group. And as often neuroscientists do when they're trying to understand how experience impacts the developing brain, they revert to animal models. So we were working with mice and rats and monkeys and barn owls, and we were doing various manipulations to see what happens when an animal was selectively reared or deprived of an experience. But we were looking for a way to look at how experience impacts brain development. And I should state further, this was near and dear to my heart because I had been many years earlier an undergraduate at McGill University when Donald Hebb was at the very end of his career. And all of us were inspired by his talking about the role of experience. Now, in his case, that meant he took his rats home in the 1930s and found that after they ran around the house for weeks and he brought them into the lab, they were smarter. Actually, this led to Head Start many years later. But, you know, I was intrigued by how experience would impact the developing brain. Some of you have heard of Harlow's work, where he did maternal separation of baby monkeys. We ran a primate model where we were separating babies from their mothers. And I invited a colleague at the time who was a pediatrician who ran a large international adoption clinic. And he had been showing films of what children in institutions look like. And as coarse as this sounds, the resemblance between the monkeys who were deprived of maternal care and the babies who were deprived of maternal care was scarily similar. So he had connections in Romania, and one thing led to another, and we launched the project that I'm about to talk about. With that background in mind, let me give you a sort of the broader public health problem. So we know that institutional care around the world is common, that UNICEF estimates that there are about 100 million children who are orphaned or abandoned, and 2 to 8 million of them, probably closer to 8 million, are living in institutions. We know that institutional or congregate care is a very common form of care for orphaned or abandoned kids in much of the world, particularly Europe, Asia, the Middle East, Central, and South America. And yet, this is not a new problem. So this is the Journal of the American Medical Association from 1915. The best conditions for the infant thus require a home and a mother. The further we get away from these vital necessities of beginning life, the greater will be our failure to get adequate results in trying to help the needy infant. Strange to say, these important conditions have often been overlooked, or at least not sufficiently emphasized by those who are working in this field. So 100 years ago, people recognized that kids abandoned to institutions did not do well. So it's an old problem for which we need new solutions. So in late 1999, early 2000, we launched an attempt to explore whether we could do a study in Bucharest, having been invited in by the government, well, a member of the government, because it turned out that Bucharest had a large problem with institutionalized kids, which I'll talk about in just a minute. So we set out to do three things. One was to examine the effects of institutionalization on brain and behavioral development among young kids who've been abandoned to institutions. I should add, we're talking about social orphans here, not orphans whose parents have died, but rather social orphans who've been abandoned. We wanted to determine if these effects could be remediated through an intervention. In our case, this was foster care. And the end goal was to improve the welfare of children in Romania and perhaps other parts of the world by establishing foster care as an alternative to institutionalization. So let me give you some background to this. This is Nicolae Ceaușescu, 1966. He was a shoe cobbler by trade, probably marginally more qualified for this than certain presidential candidates in the This is what I've been in the UK for 5 days, but my frontal lobe still sometimes comes offline from jet lag, so that's where that came from. Ceaușescu had this idea that he could increase his power if he increased the population. And so he had a couple of ideas. He passed laws to increase the population. He established the menstrual police. So these were state gynecologists who conducted monthly checks of women of childbearing age who had not had at least 5 kids. So he'd go into the workplace, and they'd examine women to make sure they weren't using birth control, they hadn't had an abortion, so on and so forth. He established a celibacy tax, which basically translated to any family that had fewer than 5 kids was taxed. He outlawed all contraception and abortion. And the result was the birth rate skyrocketed. And child abandonment became a national disaster. He basically broke down the family unit. Families couldn't afford to keep their kids. But at the same time, they were reassured that the government would take care of those kids. And this is a communist government. And many people there believed that the state would do a better job of raising children than families would. Now, there's some inconsistencies there, because people who had kids didn't routinely abandon them, saying, oh, the state will do it. It was the ones that were the poorest and disenfranchised that did this. So 1989, the Ceausescu regime falls in a coup. The Western media floods into the country and discovers more than 170,000 kids living in state-run institutions. Poverty often was the number one reason given for child abandonment, but an unwed mother, a mom who had a child with a disability, these are also common pathways to child abandonment. Large numbers of these kids started to be adopted internationally, particularly into the UK, Canada, and the United States. And there I should quickly add that Mike Rutter, who is a dear colleague who's in the Institute of Psychiatry in London, has a very long-term study, although Edmund Sonuga-Bark has now taken over the project, where he, from 1989 on, did a study of Romanian orphans brought into the UK. And I refer you to the English Romanian Adoptees study for this reason. Many of the people who adopted these kids had no idea what they were getting into. They had the impression that, well, the kids were growing up in hard circumstances, but if they just loved them enough, they'd be fine. And they weren't prepared for a lot of the developmental challenges that these kids had. So these are some pictures of institutions in Romania. I've been in institutions all over the world, and these are pretty stark, but they're not that different from others I've been in. Large numbers of kids, babies would often, there might be 15 babies in a room lying in a crib staring at a white ceiling, all swaddled. What I wanted to show you is a video of what it actually looked like. And this is a toddler room, and this is going to go for just a few minutes. And notice the number of kids, that they all look alike. It's hard to tell who's a boy and a girl, and how many caregivers are in this room, and then start to notice the stereotypies. So watch her. Watch this girl's very clingy. I'll tell you about this girl later. There's a whole other group to the left that you can't see right now. So now notice this is becoming contagious, the stereotypies. And even the little rocking this guy's doing. Notice a little bit of aggression right there. These kids are all mostly 2 to 3 years old for the most part. You'll notice that they're all independent. None of them are interacting with each other. They're just completely separate from one another. There's, you can see that the rocking just continues. And notice how stark the room is. Notice there's no toys in this room. I'll stop this in just a minute. I want to get to one frame. So now watch what happens. She just gets down to rock, and watch what this other kid does. He just suddenly moves right next to her. and gets in line with her. Okay, enough. So, why might institutionalization be bad for the brain? Regimented daily schedule, non-individualized care, sensory, social, emotional, cognitive, and linguistic deprivation, no response to distress, unchecked aggression, lack of psychological investment by caregivers, a very high ratio of kids to caregivers. So in our case, for babies, it might be 12 babies for one caregiver, and as kids get older, it might shift to 15 to 20. And at night, there might be 20 or 30 kids left with one person to take care of them. Rotating shifts of caregivers, so like you would see in a hospital, there are caregivers are coming in at different shifts, so kids really never get used to and form relationships with any given caregiver. We've known for years, I used to give this monster lecture to our medical students, meaning 3 hours or 4 hours, and I showed original films from the 1950s that Renee Spitz filmed on kids who'd abandoned to hospitals, and they're very devastating to watch. So we've known since at least the 50s that children raised in institutions are at a high risk for disturbances in social relatedness and attachment, externalizing problems like ADHD, inattention, hyperactivity, deficits in IQ and executive functions, a syndrome that mimics autism. Mike Rutter reports roughly 10% of his sample has what he calls quasi-autism. In our sample, it's about 5%, and growth stunting. The developmental problems, we believe, are the result of the deprivation inherent in institutional care. So let me give an example of growth stunting. So I will pick on Jane. Jane, are these boys or girls, and how old are they? Okay, so this is a 17-year-old girl and that's a 14-year-old girl. And so, as a rule, kids lose about a month of linear growth for every 1 month they spend in a bad institution. If the institution is better, the ratio changes a little bit. So kids are very short, and although in institutions kids can be malnourished, they weren't in our case, and they're often not. Rather, this is psychosocial dwarfism. Anyone who works in the field of child neglect recognizes that kids who experience profound neglect often don't grow, probably because the brain doesn't produce growth hormone. So, we started this study. It's the first ever randomized controlled trial of foster care as an intervention for the social deprivation inherent or associated with institutional care. We screened more than 180, there are six institutions in Bucharest. We screened more than 180 kids from all of them. We didn't want sample bias by picking one of them. We picked all of them. We were physically based at what's called number one, or St. Catherine's, where at one point there were 1,000 kids in the one institution. We screened them when they were under 1 to 2, I think, to make sure we didn't have kids who had frank neurological or genetic problems or fetal alcohol syndrome, just based on physical exam. Now, this is imperfect in some cases when kids are very young. Things slip through the cracks, and we now know we have some kids that probably are syndromic that we didn't know then. Of the 180, we wound up with 136 that we thought looked pretty good. They ranged in age from 6 to 31 months. We did an extensive baseline assessment on them, and then when the mean age was around 20 months. And I should add that when I talk about critical periods, which I'll get to in about 5 minutes, the shortcoming of this work is the kids on average are 20 months of age. We wanted them to be much younger, but I insisted that we do a feasibility study to make sure that this major project we were going to launch far away would not be for naught. Also, Romania had a long history of graft, and I didn't want to start spending money that was disappearing into the pockets of other people. So after a year of a feasibility study, we realized we could do the study, but then the kids got a year older. So that's why they're relatively old. Following the baseline assessment, we randomly assigned half of them to remain in the institution, and half of them were randomly assigned to a foster care intervention that we built. And then we had 72 kids that grew up in the city and their families, had never been in an institution. The original goal was to follow these three groups for about 42 months. So we saw them at 9, 18, 30, and 42 months. And then I found a little bit of money and we did a limited assessment at 54 months. And then I said, I'm done going to Romania. But then I found some more money and we saw them again at 8. And then I said, I'm done going to Romania, but then I found some more money. You know where this is going, right? We saw them at 12, and we're now about halfway through a 16-year follow-up. For those of you who work in the field of genetics, I think there's a SNP for doing longitudinal studies of a genetic polymorphism that I have. We're now seeing our kids at 16. My two colleagues in this, Charlie Zena, child psychiatrist, and Nathan Fox, a developmental psychologist, who I'd like to point out are far older than I am, want to see these kids again as they make the transition to adulthood, which will be in a few years. I'll be reporting today on the data through age 12. Now, the three of us have very different backgrounds, so everything has been a negotiation about what we think is the most important thing to study. So we would sit around saying, well, we should do this, we should do this, and this is eventually what we did. Obviously, the negotiations didn't work very well because there's almost nothing not on this list. And so at the age of 16, it requires four separate test sessions and zillions of other things that are going on, sampling, saliva, finger pricks, imaging, and the like. Now, since some of you, the minute I said half were remained in institutions and half went to foster care, were thinking, how could you do that? Let me briefly touch on some of the ethical issues in this project. So, we did this in Romania because they had a big problem. There were a lot of kids there, and it was an opportunity to look at early adverse experiences, in this case, neglect. But more importantly, we were invited in by a member, he was then the Minister of Child Protection in the country. Romania actually was interested in developing policies for dealing with abandoned kids because they had a big problem on their hand. And rather than try to deal with it by preventing child abandonment, they thought they should just deal with it on what to do with the kids once they've been abandoned. They actually conceived of the idea that institutions were the beneficial intervention for child abandonment. And when we started, we were basically told we were crazy, that everyone knows that the children will do better in institutions than in families, and that the only family that would take a child unrelated to them into their home would be a pedophile or something terrible. So we were told that this was nuts, that the only reason the kids in institutions look different is because they were different to begin with. And this dated back to the Soviet principle of defectology, that these were defective kids to begin with, and that's what got them into an institution. And I remember having a conversation on an early trip there with one of the physicians who was in the institution, and there was a girl who clearly had autism and other things, and he was telling me that she seemed fine for the first year or so, but then she looked like this. Had I ever seen anything like this? And he had not connected the dots that her phenotype might be related to having been in the institution. He thought it was sort of a delayed onset to something else. We had consent, our institutional review board, ethical consent from all the US universities, all the local authorities in Romania, and the caregivers and parents and guardians involved in the study. We could do random assignment because there was no foster care when we started. We had to create our own. And that was not easy. So after extensive advertising and then screening, we could only identify 58 families that we thought would be good foster care families. So we placed 68 kids in those 58 families because we kept siblings together, another ethical requirement. We had a policy of non-interference. Any child that we placed that was assigned to the institutional group, if they had the opportunity to leave, they could. The government would come in and reunite them with their biological family. Later, they would put them into government foster care and things like that. As I go through the data in a little bit, all of our findings adopt what's called an intent to treat design, meaning the data are analyzed based on the kids' original group assignment. By the time the kids were 12, there were only 20 kids still living in an institution. But if we analyze the data separately, like those 20, then there could be reasons why the other 48 left. So this avoids sample bias, but it also means our findings are conservative. People in public health get that, but I've learned, including myself initially, that psychologists often don't get intent to treat. So is it clear what I mean, why we did this? Okay. Children were free to change group assignment. And once the efficacy, so if you're doing a clinical trial, I'm doing a trial of diabetes, everyone in this room, You get a drug, you get placebo. 6 months into this, I find out everyone who's getting the drug, your diabetes is cured and there's no side effects. I either then have to give all of you the drug, or to deal with an issue called clinical equipoise, I have to stop the trial so you're not advantaged over you. When we peaked at the data about a year into this, we realized we were seeing major effects of foster care. But if we stopped the study, all the kids in foster care would go back to the institution, and there still wasn't enough foster care to go around. So we used this scientific principle called shaming, where with the US ambassador to Romania, we called a national press conference, and we invited all members of the government and the press to this meeting, and we basically said, look at our data. And within a year, the government passed legislation forbidding the institutionalization of any child under 2 unless they were handicapped. So clearly they heard us. And they started government foster care. And finally, we have what's called a data safety monitoring board in place, so that if we have this independent board that lives outside of our group, and if anyone in the project feels that they've been coerced, that they've been taken advantage of, they have any concerns at all, they go to this independent board. All right, so that's sort of an arm's length policy. Let me tell you about the foster care intervention, and then I'm going to go into the data. So we screened all these families, found 58 that we thought were good, 68 kids were placed with those 58. All the families were provided a monthly stipend. So in the US, I'm not sure what it's like in the UK, but in the US, families are paid piecemeal, like a certain amount per kid. Here, they were given a living wage, and we set the wage at the average per capita income in Romania at that time. Very close monitoring. We had social workers. When we started this project, we had 3 social workers, 10 staff, a car, and an apartment. This was a major infrastructure undertaking. The social workers visited the families every 10 days, and every 7 days, they met with us either in person or in Skype to talk about problems that were going on. Many of the problems, you know, were not surprising to us, and so the social workers would work with the families to help them deal with the kids. Kids could hoard food, they might not want to take a bath, they might, you know, any number of things. We provided all material support, diapers, toys, things like that. We had a 24-hour on-call pediatrician, and Romania law required one parent to stay at home with the child, so they couldn't put the child into, say, daycare. And all the families were licensed. So this was high-quality foster care. This is not what we might call garden-variety foster care. So I know what it's like to sit through an hour-long talk and not be able to ask questions. If you have any questions about the ethics of the foster care, I'm happy to entertain those now before I get into the findings. Okay. Yes? Oh no, they were all in Bucharest. So no one left the country. These were all Bucharest families.
Because you mentioned earlier there was no infrastructure in the country.
Right.
Yeah,
so let me qualify that. There was no foster care in Bucharest. In outlying regions of Romania, some counties had started foster care, but not in Bucharest. So that's why we had to start our own. Okay. So, as I said, intent to treat. The data are analyzed based on care as usual, meaning institutional care, or foster care, or never institutionalized. So we'll start with cognitive development. So I'm a cognitive neuroscientist, and I like to think of really sophisticated ways to peer into the brain and understand things like cognition. But in this case, we use the Bailey exam to start with. The Bailey is a developmental assessment, and later we switch to formal IQ testing. You'll hear about that in a minute. Norm to 100. So 100 would be the population mean. And at baseline, before randomization, as you can see, the children in the never institutional group have a Bailey score of 103, exactly what you'd expect. This is important because it meant the Bailey was, in a sense, behaving in Romania as it did anywhere else. Because if the instrument was culturally inept in some ways, then our findings would be skewed. So the Bailey was behaving like we hoped it would. Notice that the mental development index of the kids in the institutional group, hi Jennifer, was 64, which is well below average. In fact, by old standards, these kids fit the criteria of intellectual disability, or what used to be referred to as mental retardation. First wave of foster care. So we'll start with this, 30 months, 42, 54 months. You can see in every instance, the kids in foster care have much higher IQs than the kids in the institution. This is not a drop. We switched instruments. We went from the Bally to the WPSI, and then later to the WISC, for those of you familiar with these instruments. So this is just an artifact of the test. But notice, if you look at the difference, that stays the same. So through 54 months, we see this big intervention effect. But much more interesting to us was what we call the timing effect. If you look here, these are only foster care data. The kids placed in foster care before 2 have markedly higher IQs than the kids placed after 2. And this is what we meant by a critical period. So in fact, the IQ of the kids placed in foster care after 2 was much closer to the kids who've never left the institution. But these IQs, although higher, were still not as good as the kids who never were in an institution. I'm going to skip through 8 and go right to age 12. So now we're using the WISC. We have all these subscales. But look at the full-scale IQ. We still see the kids in foster care have higher IQs than the kids in the institution. But notice, the mean is still not quite 80. So we're not making these kids look as good as the kids who've never been in an institution. But remember what I said about the average age of placement being 20 months. So it's possible this is because the kids were placed relatively late. But that's that. So young children living in institutions show significant delays in IQ. Removal of an institution, particularly before 24 months, leads to better outcomes in after 24 months. We still see intervention effects at age 12. Those of you who are familiar with the early intervention literature know that intervention effects, particularly in cognition, often wash out. So in the famous US study Head Start, by the time kids hit 4 or 5, they lost all their IQ gains for the most part. So these IQ gains persist. But the last thing that I took out when I was editing the talk right before you walked in is that besides the timing effect, the other thing we see is a stability of placement effect. The kids in foster care who do the best are the ones who went from the institution to foster care and stayed put. But the kids who have multiple placements do much worse. And any of you who work in child protection recognize this. Multiple foster care placements are not good for kids. And so we see the same thing. The kids who did the worst in the institutional group were the ones who were pulled out of the institution, reunited with their biological parents, put in foster care, reabandoned, back and forth. So let's turn now to attachment. I'm going to assume that everyone understands the concept of attachment. We think it lays the groundwork for subsequent relationships with peers and adults. So perturbations and attachments early in life could alter the trajectory of other aspects of social emotional development. So at 12 and 18 months, we did what's called the strange situation, which may or may not be familiar to you. I'm going to show you a video in a second. So here, a child, let's say with mom, is in the room. There's some toys. You observe the child playing when the mom is present. And then a stranger walks in. You observe what happens when the stranger's in the room with the mother. Then the mother leaves, and you observe what the child does when just with the stranger. Then the stranger leaves, and you observe what happens when the child's left alone. And then the mother comes back, and you observe what happens when the child now is reunited with the mother. So this is an 18-month-old little guy. He's now been left alone, and we'll watch this. Does anyone speak Romanian? You do? Can you understand what she's... Okay, so that's sort of a classic reunion episode. Except that's the first time he's ever seen her. And that's what I'm going to get to in just a minute. And this is what we refer to as indiscriminate behavior. So he jumps into her arms and he acts like, you know, she's the best thing ever, but he's never met her before. So at baseline, before randomization, we can look at secure attachment, or an insecure attachment, you notice that for the never institutionalized group, nearly 80% have a secure attachment, and then, you know, 20% or so have an insecure attachment. The kids in the institutional group are exactly the reverse. So there are as many kids in the institutional group who have an insecure attachment as there are kids with a secure attachment in the never institutional group. Now let's turn to the foster care intervention. Let's just look at the middle. The kids placed in foster care before 22 months, 70% have a secure attachment. The kids placed in foster care after 22 months, 70% have an insecure attachment. The same critical period that we saw in IQ. So then we wanted to up the ante. We wanted to make this more functional. And so we did this task that our ethics committee had some problems with in the beginning. We did this at 54 months and at 8 years. We arrange for the caregiver, we say to the caregiver, a stranger is going to knock on the door. Let your child answer the door and let them do whatever they want to do. So the knock on the door comes and the stranger says to the kid, come with me, I have something to show you. And all we're looking for is, does the child walk off with this complete stranger? This is like every parent's worst nightmare, right? Walking off with a complete stranger. So let's start at 54 months. In the institutional group, more than 50% walked off with a complete stranger. In the foster care group, it's cut in half. It's down to about 25%. And there was one kid in the community who did this, so we're closely monitoring this kid ever since, right? If you look at 8 years, now 8 years, kids go off with strangers, they're in school, things like that, but still, you kind of know the boundaries. The slope of the function is exactly the same. So foster care cuts in half, but does not get rid of this kind of indiscriminate behavior. Now, there are pathological forms of indiscriminate behavior called a reactive attachment disorder. And there are two types, the emotionally withdrawn inhibited and the indiscriminately social or disinhibited. The former are kids who, in the presence of a caregiver, will freeze. Those of you who might work in the field of anxiety or fear know that under certain conditions of powerful, fearful stimuli, people will just lock up and freeze. And when I've seen some of Charlie's films, you know, some of these kids actually look like they're having an Opsahn seizure. Social disinhibited would be the kid I showed you in that video. They just walk off with a complete stranger. Out of curiosity, have any of you been in an institution, ever visited an orphanage? All right, so, you know, one of the things you know is that if you walk in, kids you've never seen before walk right up to you. They'll hold your hand, sit in your lap, and things like that. So let's look at the data. This is the withdrawn depressed type based on caregiver report all the way through 8 years. These are the never institutionalized kids. They're just at floor level. These are the kids in the institutional group. Now remember, now at 8 years, there's only 24 kids who still live in an institution. This is intent to treat, remember? So by 8 years, they've declined, but they're still way high. And these are the kids in the foster care group who very quickly come down to the same level as the never institutional group, and then they stay there. So it's as though for this type of reactive attachment disorder, placement in foster care completely gets rid of the problem. But that's not the case for this type. These are the kids in the never institutional group. You know, when you're really little, you'll go off with a stranger. Sometime around 18 months, though, is when things shift. But now look here. These are the kids in foster care, and these are the institutional group. And they decline, but these are still high. So we don't knock out indiscriminate behavior completely. And in fact, dating back to studies done in London by Tizard in the 1960s, this sort of behavior seems to be particularly resistant to treatment. What about timing? Well, these are the kids placed in foster care before 24 months, and these are the kids placed in foster care after 24 months. And they eventually settle down at 8, but all the way up to that time, you can see there's a big effect, that the kids placed earlier get rid of more of this behavior sooner. So attachments profoundly compromise in institutionalized children. Foster care ameliorates some attachment disturbances. Earlier foster care is more effective than later foster care, and foster care placement does not completely ameliorate the disorder. So let's turn to mental health. We looked at mental health at 54 months, at 8 years, 12 years. We're doing it at 16 again. I'm only going to talk about the 12-year data because these are the most recently published data. In our typical fashion of being unable to decide what's important, you can see all the things that we looked at, all right? We wanted to get a handle on everything. So we did the DISC, a structured psychiatric interview that was administered by our psychologists. So let's start here. Let's just look at any disorder, any DSM disorder. If you look at the EIG, you'll see why I'm doing this in a minute. Ever institutionalized refers to kids in either the institutional group or foster care group. We pooled them because we only saw intervention effects in some domains. So you see that 40% of the kids who have ever been in an institution meet criteria for at least one DSM-based diagnosis, whereas it's a little higher than 15% in the never institutionalized group. If you look at internalizing, like anxiety and depression, there's no group difference now. It's hovering at around 15%, and I'll come back to why that's important. If you look at externalizing and ADHD, so this could be things like conduct disorder or disruptive behavior disorder, you'll see that it's very high in the ever-institutionalized kid. In fact, the rate of ADHD among kids who've been in an institution hovers at around 20%, and it's been like that for the first 12 years of life. So let's break this down. Let's just look at ADHD. Care as usual, kids in the institutional group, foster care, and care, I knew I did this wrong, never institutional group. I kept thinking, why? If 15% of the general population is like that, we have a problem. No. So this is the never institutionalized group. This is foster care. This is care as usual. This, I didn't put error bars up there, but as you can tell from here, these actually don't differ. So there's no intervention effect for ADHD, and there was not at any earlier age either. But there was a big intervention effect for internalizing. At 54 months, 45% of the kids in the institutional group had an anxiety disorder. But kids in foster care, that was cut in half. But by 12, it looks like internalizing has started to go away, externalizing has stayed put. Now, a particular form of psychopathology that we're very worried about is callous unemotional traits. So the issue here is that, is this a precursor to psychopathy? Many people believe that it may have its roots in early disturbances in attachment relationship. So these are the kids who are torturing animals and, you know, doing the scary things that when you see four-year-olds do this, you start to worry. So briefly, what you see is the care as usual kids, boys in particular, have a very high rate of callous and emotional traits. In fact, in both cases, you can see that it's very low in the never institutionalized group. And it's very low in the kids in foster care. It's high in boys and girls, but of course higher in boys, which is consistent with the literature. So very high prevalence of psychopathology among ever institutionalized children. Relative to 54 months, internalizing symptoms have dramatically declined among the ever-institutionalized kids. Externalizing remains high and seems to be resistant to intervention. Now remember, our intervention is simply putting kids in high-quality foster care into good families. So we didn't target ADHD, but we thought that this would help, and it didn't. And we also see this high rate of callous and emotional traits. Now I will say now that we had another ethical requirement that any child that we put in foster care would never be returned to the institution. And we worked with the government and with NGOs to make sure this would happen. But it turned out that as these kids started traversing into adolescence, that went to hell. And the reason is that some of these kids became so difficult to manage, and the psychological and psychiatric care in Bucharest is not so good, that I think now 10 foster care families have had to give up their kids, often because their kids have threatened to kill them. And so we're very concerned about very serious psychopathology as these kids get into adolescence. All right, we're going to kind of close out on the brain, because for me, we want to be able to explain the behavioral phenotype, and one way to do that is to see what's going on in the brain. So we started by just doing EEG on the kids. So compared to the at baseline, compared to the kids in the community, the never institutionalized group, the kids in the institutionalized group have much lower levels of brain activity across different brain regions and frequency bands. So This is baseline, remember. What you're looking at is a view. If you place sensors on the top of the head and record the brain's electrical activity, you can then color code this to represent more or less brain activity. So in this scheme, red represents much more brain activity and blue or green would represent less brain activity. This is a view from the top down, nose, back of the head, left ear, right ear. Look at the difference in the never institutionalized kids compared to the institutionalized kids. And one way to analogize this would be a strong light bulb versus a weak light bulb, all right? So we're seeing a great reduction. These kids are on average only 20 months, so this is just what happens at baseline. So let's turn to 8 years. Care as usual, kids placed in foster care after 2. These are groups are identical. Kids placed in foster care before 2, kids never been in an institution, and they're identical. So the same similar critical period again. Placement before roughly 2 leads to what looks like large recovery. What about 12? It's more, a little more complicated now. So in normal EEG, as you get older, less theta is good and more alpha and beta and things like that would be good. What we see for theta activity is much higher theta in the care as usual than either of these groups. And for alpha, much higher alpha in care as usual, in never institutionalized in foster care compared to care as usual. In other words, we still see a big intervention effect, but we lost a timing effect. And we might want to come back to that when we have a discussion later. So, briefly, kids placed in foster care before 24 months have EEGs at 8 that resembles the never institutionalized group. Kids placed after 24 months have EEGs at age 8 that resembles the institutionalized group. Timing matters. As was the case with IQ, at age 12, we still observe an intervention effect, but the timing effect is gone. So then what about other measures of brain activity? So I spent a lot of time with colleagues who knew much more about developmental neurobiology than I did, pondering what's going on in the brain that leads it to produce so much less brain activity. And the answers were all not good. A reduction in cell number, a reduction in synapses, a retraction of spines, any number of things. So we can't look at that level of detail in the human, but we can do MRIs on the kids, and so that's what we did. So when the kids are 8 to 10, and now we're repeating it at 16, we did structural MRI. We cannot do functional MRI. I just have to say as an aside, I find that amazing. So I run a big lab in Dhaka, Bangladesh, which is, by all means, a much lower resource country than Romania. And I do beautiful functional imaging in babies in Dhaka, but we can't do functional imaging in Bucharest. So start with gray matter. So gray matter tends to be cell bodies and non-myelinated elements. If it's cell bodies, this is sort of where the computations are being done. And we see no intervention effect. The never institutionalized kids have much more gray matter than either the institutionalized kids in foster care. If you look at white matter, sort of the myelinated tracts that transmit information, now we see the beginning of an intervention effect. So the never institutionalized has more white matter volume than either of these other groups, and this has more than this. So the beginning of an intervention effect, but we're not normalizing white matter volume. Then we did diffusion tensor imaging. We wanted to look at the integrity of these white matter fibers. Just so briefly, if you look at the dispersion of water molecules along a fiber that has myelin, the more heavily myelinated the fiber is, the less dispersion. And you have different ways of assaying this. One measure is fractional anisotropy or medial diffusivity. That really doesn't matter. Let me show you. So we look at the body of the corpus callosum, right, which is right in here. We see no intervention effect. So the white matter integrity is much lower in the kids in the foster care group or the never institutional group than it is in the kids who've never been institutionalized. So it's easier to look at here, where you can see this is a measure of fractional anisotropy, this is medial diffusivity, and I don't want to get into what those things mean, but you see the effect here. So no, for the body of the corpus callosum, no intervention effect at all. But for parts of the limbic system, the fornix and the cingulum, now we see an intervention effect. You see that white matter integrity in this bundle, the fornix or the cingulum, is the same in foster care as is in the never institutionalized group. We went through 48 fiber cracks. I'm not going to do that. But the point then is that we see selective intervention effects. Some tracks recover, some do not. And this likely can explain some of our behavioral findings as well. So dramatic reductions in gray and white matter, partial remediation of white. DTI reveals some white matter tracks recover, some others do not. So sort of consistent with the story through 12 years, not all domains benefit from the interventions, but some do. So I'm going to close by discussing stress. The worry we had was that kids learn to manage stress by having an invested caregiver who helps them figure out how to respond to stressful situations. So I'll give you an example. The house I'm currently living in, when I moved in, we had a very rambunctious dog. It was a boxer. And boxers just, like, they just love jumping on people. Next door neighbor came out. Dad came out with his four-year-old son. Son calls the dog. Dog runs to the son, jumps up, clocks this kid, knocks him right on his back. Normally, that would be frightening. But what the dad did is the kid immediately looked to the father as though to say, okay, how am I supposed to feel in this situation? Dad handled it beautifully. He just said, Katie's just being friendly. You called her. This is just her way of showing she likes you. And then they were best friends. Kids learn to deal with stress through a mechanism like that. What if you don't have someone who's invested in you? So we did this thing, another thing that our institutional review board had a concern with. Lots of evidence from the animal literature that animals deprived have altered hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. The response to stress is altered. Their ability to regulate a stress response is impaired. So I'm just going to skip that. So we did what's called the Trier stress test. This is me, and this is you, right? So the kid is told they have to deliver a speech about what makes a good friend, and they have to do this in front of two teachers they've never met before. They're not real teachers. And we record all kinds of autonomic activity, heart rate, what's called impedance cardiography, cortisol, blood pressure, during the time you're preparing the speech. So like those of you who got here early noticed I was still writing my talk when you were coming in. So that's the preparation phase. During the speech itself, and you're given negative and neutral feedback. So like Jane has been sitting here glaring at me the whole time. How does that make me feel? And then after that, we do a little math test. Like you have to count backwards from 100 by sevens or something. So if you look here, preparation, speech, and math, the normative response is to have an elevated heart rate. So during all phases, the never institutionalized kids show a much higher heart rate than the kids in the institutional group or in foster care. But you see an intervention effect in these two conditions. So the kids in foster care had a heart rate increase that was more than the institutional kids, but not as high as the never institutional kids. If you look at cortisol, this stands for the Trier stress test. This is actually during the time that you're judging me. You notice that the never institutionalized have a big elevation in cortisol, but the other two groups don't. Right? So they're showing a flattened cortisol response. So their heart rate's not increasing, their cortisol is not being released. But what about timing of placement? This is the court data. These are the kids placed after 24 months. Oh, my legend got missed, lost. And these are the kids placed before 24 months. The kids placed before 24 months show a normative court response. Kids placed after 24 months don't. And the same goes for heart rate. This is change in heart rate, and it's complicated. This is a change in respiratory sinus arrhythmia, but all you have to notice is that during all three phases, these are the kids placed before 18 months, these are the kids placed after 18 months. Now, notice I've said 24 months sometimes, 22 months sometimes, 18 months. If I talked about language, I would have gone younger. If I talked about physical growth, I would have talked younger. So there's not a critical period. Critical periods vary by domain. And sometimes even within domain. Even within the domain of language, there are different critical periods. So Psychosocial deprivation is associated with pervasive pattern of blunted physiological response to stress in both the sympathetic nervous system and in the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. Random assignment to high-quality family care following institutionalization mitigates otherwise persistent effects of early psychosocial deprivation on the functioning of the stress response system. Earlier aged placement into foster care leads to a normalization of the court response and enhanced vagal engagement, meaning that your heart rate is engaged in what you're doing. So, conclusions. Children raised in institutions during early development demonstrate significant impairments in physical, cognitive, language, social, emotional, and brain development compared to community children. St. Mark Johnson is here. I have to say that the only domain unaffected by institutionalization was face processing, which was not what I predicted. Insofar as we've been able to look at our data, our model of foster care as an intervention appears to effectively ameliorate most, but not all, of the negative sequelae. The domains in particular that were resistant to treatment were executive functions and ADHD. So the implications. It's imperative to find alternatives to institutionalization. Children already in institutions should spend as little time there as possible, and ideally should be removed before they're two. And finally, forgetting about institutions, just think about the tens of or hundreds of thousands of kids around the world in child protection. In the United States alone, there are tens of thousands who are bounced from one foster care home to another, or worse, are allowed to stay in a home where they're being maltreated for a very long time until a judge finally makes a decision to get them out. So thank you for your time. Oops. And I'll take questions.